Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 12th day now of September 2020, one day after what's arguably the biggest false flag and cover-up in American history that was, of course, used to foment and expand the police state that we're still dealing with, although it just keeps getting worse. And oh yeah, I'm your host Mark Colland. Case in point, let's start off our review of the week that was with this one because it's so representative. Twitter says that it will remove any tweets that dare to claim victory on behalf of, well, especially that guy that's probably going to win by a landslide, and you all know who we're talking about, even if Twitter won't let you say it, before election results have been certified. And who certifies it? Why, socialist media and their minions, of course. Oh, and here I have to note, folks, that the word certify does not appear anywhere in the Constitution with regard to elections, but Electoral College does. Here's the story from Steve Watson and others, Zero Hedge Summit News, etc. Twitter further extended their censorship policies on Thursday, announcing they will label as false information and or remove any posts that dare to claim election victory before results have been officially certified. So, bottom line, if you see election fraud up close and in person and try to tweet about it, you will be dealt with. Starting next week, the totalitarian socialist public-private partner said, we will label or remove or both any misleading information, and they decide, intended to undermine public confidence in the election, except, of course, the very things that they're doing. And this includes, but it's not limited to, false or misleading information that causes confusion, especially among the easily confused, like the aged, the senile, and those running for president, about the laws and regulation of a civic process, disputed claims that could undermine faith in the process itself, and I guess if you really want to just make sure that nothing happens, dispute any and every claim that you don't like, that is, if you're far enough left, i.e., they say, unverified information, and guess who verifies it? About election rigging, ballot tampering, vote tallying, or certification of election results. And finally, misleading claims about the results or outcome of a civic process which calls for or could lead to interference with the implementation of the results of the process. In case that's a little bit too obtuse, if you're a Republican claiming victory before the election results have been certified by the far left. Now let me give you an easy, an intended case in point on that front. Nancy Pelosi easily wins re-election. She will be renewed as Speaker of the House, and therefore she is allowed a second in line behind the VP, who won't be allowed to take the office when the election results are disputed by those who hold the power to deny certification until it's too late. Can you see how this works? If not, folks, you're going to get to see it in action in just a couple of months. Just don't expect to be allowed to talk about it, especially on Twitter or to Facebook. Oh, and get this. They also include inciting unlawful conduct to prevent a peaceful transfer of power. Notice how they phrase it? Yeah, that's what they're planning on. A transfer of power, whether it's peaceful or not. And this is part of the ongoing narrative, no doubt about it, to convince formerly free Americans they're going to have to deal with delay and might have to wait for weeks or even months, or maybe they'll never hear the answer about whether the guy who wasn't supposed to win really did win by a landslide or the senile one just managed to steal it in spite of his impediment. So where next other than election rigging? This came out midweek. I've got at least three different takes on the very same story out of the far-left Daily Beast, which recently published an article describing preparations of dozens of truly fascist, though some of them claim anti in their name, groups, including, of course, the communists and the Democrats, but we repeat ourselves, for what happens after their senile version of Joseph Stalin, along with his Soros sock puppet in waiting, is rejected in a massive landslide come November. And true to the Hitlerian big lie, along with the Rules for Radicals update, they blame their enemies for doing exactly what they intend. The Daily Beast POC is actually entitled, "The Left Secretly Preps for MAGA Violence After Election Day." Oh yeah, they're prepping, all right. And any MAGA violence will be defensive, and arguably way too late. Former CIA analyst and counterterrorism expert Kevin Shipp puts it this way, The article is really not talking about Trump supporters engaging in violence. It's talking about plans that the so-called progressive left is making to engage in violence. He says if, I'm going to say when, but that means if they're not able to rig it and get it sold. The article states, quote, over the course of 2 hours, participants in these secret meetings broached the questions of what the progressive political ecosystem can functionally do in a series of election scenarios. They began charting out what it would take to stand up to a multi-state communications arm to fight disinformation, a training program for non-violent civil disobedience. I think that's because they've got a pretty good violent one already well underway, and the underpinnings of what one official described as mass public unrest. And yep, they've been working on that for quite a while as they pored over a report from the Transition Integrity Project. Can you believe the whoppers that they put in these names? Well, at least we're getting used to it. A bipartisan group formed in 2019 that analyzed various election season scenarios and made clear the type of I can't even read this word, rat effery, corruption, and chaos that potentially was ahead. Yeah, if they were able to pull it off. Quote, the potential for violent conflict is high, said the report, unquote, and then they patted themselves on the back. For her part, Susan Duclos, writing for the All News Pipeline, focused on the obvious spin contained throughout the article. Number one, it completely ignores history. Two, it shows these groups are planning unrest should Trump win the Electoral College, which, along with the rest of the Constitution, they not only hate anyway, but never really understood the point of to begin with. Number three, it claims that it's conservatives that will take certain actions that to date only far leftists have taken, and it's been well documented with video proof that they have done so. Number four, it assumes throughout the whole article that Mr. Dementia himself, Joe Biden, wins in every conceivable scenario, and that just means they think they've really got the rigging in the bag. And number five, it discusses how these left-wing liberal groups are actively preparing for mass public unrest should they not be able to snag the election. Or, and none of these stories actually emphasize this point again, are able to sandbag, obfuscate, and delay it long enough, with criminal tactics like their 80 million illegal vote tsunami starting after the election, and if they get their way, lasting into January or beyond, while they cavort in the House of Representatives and try to come in through the back door. Schiff says, as he will reveal in the Schiff Intelligence Report, the Democrat Party, the Progressive Left, Black Lives Matter, and Antifa are all planning and will carry out violence in the streets of cities across the nation, and essentially, they will start a violent civil war. Schiff calls it the Dark Left, noting they're planning violence, looting, physical attacks, knockout tactics, and attacks on rural neighborhoods that will in some cases become deadly, and suggests that people who aren't aware yet of what's going on had better get that way real soon and start planning. The Gateway Pundit's Jim Hoft adds one compelling question. Just when, oh when, are these groups going to be finally labeled what they are? Domestic terrorists engage in an act of insurrection against the Constitutional Republic of the United States. From there, on we go to the World War III front, well, actually fronts, plural. There is now a major deployment, says a piece from Hal Turner's radio show, of army troops on the India-China border after clashes between those two armies. And in fact, the deployment has gone beyond major and now actually constitutes a massive deployment. He's got video and notes that tens of thousands of additional Indian army troops are presently on the move. While meanwhile, China has begun deploying literally tens of thousands of additional troops to its side of the same border area. For weeks, and this has been soft-pedaled in the waste stream, both China and India have said that they want to de-escalate the tensions, but after recent skirmishes where shots have been exchanged, it's clear both sides are upping the ante, and seriously. From there, Hal Turner goes on to describe one of the standard scenarios, which said, obviously, as the conflict begins to spread, the U.S. would back India and China, so it's believed, would then engage Taiwan to force the U.S. to spread itself thinner in the defense of Taiwan via that treaty. At this point, it's believed Pakistan might enter the fray against India, forcing the U.S. to further engage, all of which flare-ups would finally open the door for North Korea to engage the South in some menacing manner. There seems to be an October surprise planned with an ICBM or something on that front to boot, forcing the U.S. to again spread itself into yet a third battle zone. Oh, and let's not forget, the situation between Greece and Turkey is now getting hotter, with Turkey now openly talking about waging war upon Greece over oil and gas drilling rights in the eastern Mediterranean and Aegean Seas, which could even kick off first, forcing the U.S. to choose sides, and apparently we've already chosen Greece, and if this is the one that kicks off first, China would then probably escalate with India, thinking the U.S. is already occupied. Oh, and let's not forget Russia, 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 which probably really does have a bone to pick with the deep state, because among other things, they're tired of U.S. NATO interference with Ukraine and now Belarus, not to mention interference in Syria. And they're probably tired of being falsely accused of collusion in the 2016 presidential election to boot. And you know what, folks? I'm getting to the point where I almost wouldn't blame them if they decided to nuke America just because they wanted to finally take out Hitlery, since it looks like Donald Trump never will. People in Beirut are panicking again because 1 month after the August 4 ammonium nitrate blast, or so we're told, which leveled entire parts of the Lebanese capital and killed at least 190 people while wounding over 6,000, Beirut is in panic again as another huge fire engulfed the port on Thursday. Reported Al Jazeera, a massive new fire is raging, and there was no information immediately available about what caused it, but sent a large column of black smoke into the sky, which can be seen for miles. The cause is yet unknown, and officials are offering few details. And this probably, note most of the stories, like the one in Zero Hedge, do anything at all to help quell the anger of the public about government negligence and corruption centered on that port, since the Arabic phrase for utter incompetence, or worse, is already trending. So what the heck? With that as an introduction, let's go right into our conspiracy theory sequence for the day. Although I think we're going to have to rename that one. So many long-standing conspiracy theories are now being proven so correct that maybe we need to call it what a physicist would. Not quite yet a conspiracy law, but getting really close. In other words, if the media calls it a conspiracy theory, that's basically equivalent to confirmed beyond any reasonable doubt. In other words, since we're already talking about suspicious fires that are blamed on other things that physics-wise at least don't make any sense, like ammonium nitrate bombs in Beirut, oh, not to mention huge major fires all up the left coast, California into Oregon. Clearly, though, forest mismanagement and utter incompetence play a big role, but there's been quite a bit of planning to fail, too. And us ham radio operators will remember how California prepped for all of this by making sure that repeater communications in the area were properly taken out months ago. And now, and by the way, not for the first time, recall, for example, lots and lots of unusual anomalies, to put it mildly, with the Paradise Fire last year. There are people asking really weird questions, like this one. With arson an obvious and undeniable possibility, and plenty of nutcases around to do it, given the degree here, and now some evidence, too, could there be something even worse at play? Are directed energy weapons actually responsible for starting fires in California and Oregon? That, in fact, is the headline from the Washington Standard, picked up by places like Max Slavo and his SHTF plan. A directed energy weapon, it says, was caught on a live stream going right into a fire in California. There was another shown igniting a fire in Oregon, and now that's been followed up by a black censorship line placed through the beam. What's going on? It was discovered by YouTuber Dutch Sense, who saw something unbelievable while looking at the fires in the western United States and studying earthquakes, as he's done for years, around the world. When first noticed, Dutch Sense called it, quote, some kind of a ray or beam of some kind, unquote. And after all of that, Dutch Sense discovered another DEW last night, which makes it at least two in a row. This one appears to come from the ocean and into a fire that's just started in Oregon. And after the discovery, he noticed that someone decided to censor the beam online by literally putting a black censorship bar over the heat signature, saying, trying to hide it, though, they tried to match the black of the background, but because the original live gray feed black is impossible to perfectly match, we now have a mismatched black line hiding the original beam. Ha ha, he says, look close and you'll see it. It's an epic fail. Still, though, it has more and more people asking questions like, if it's not a DEW, what is it and why all the effort to hide it? And besides, folks, let's be realistic here. Can you think of anybody on the left coast who would actually want to destroy their own state? Well, beside all the obvious candidates anyway, in Sacramento, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Portland. Moving on, the far left-stream media is just plain beside themselves with anticipation over the new Bob Woodward anti-Trump book about to be published. The Daily Mail, for example, just couldn't help themselves. They had to have no less than 3 consecutive banner headlines talking about the book and saying how awful it was that the president agreed to be interviewed. One says, inside Bob Woodward's 18 Trump interviews. Why on earth, they ask, could the president give the Watergate reporter such bombshells? He would occasionally unburden himself to Bob Woodward, giving him his personal cell phone number for late-night telephone calls. An immediate follow-up says the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, said he would not have recommended that Trump give those 18 interviews to Bob Woodward. After tapes reveal how the president played down the booga 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 virus threat, well, the Daily Mail could hardly be accused of that. Why, just look at their other really scary booga 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 virus headlines on any given day, but especially today. Here's just one, quote, revealed at least 4 teachers have died from booga 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 COVID-1984 since the start of the school year, including a 28-year-old third grade teacher in South Carolina. And guess what they're not telling you? Yeah, for one, any hint of comorbidities, although the pictures may give us a clue. Anyway, and then there's this. Trump also revealed nuclear secrets. Yeah, can you believe it? Maybe not. To Bob Woodward in those late-night calls on his personal cell, and he said he had a new weapon system that Putin and Xi Jinping knew nothing about. Well, let's talk then about what they don't seem to want to. This piece comes from The American Thinker and Andrea Woodberg, entitled, There's Something Very Wrong with Some, at least in the top ranks of America's military. And what with Bob Woodward's new anti-Trump book, it says, about to be published, the media's focused entirely on the easily debunked claim that Trump mishandled the booga 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 Wuhan COVID-1984 coronavirus by lying, and she puts it in quotes at least, to the American people. What the media is ignoring, however, is a much more serious claim, which is that former Secretary of Defense James Mattis plotted to overthrow Trump and his administration. Some of us never liked that scumbag from the beginning. And that fact, if true, she points out, supports my longtime fear about the damage Obama inflicted on the upper echelons of the Pentagon. Now, this, folks, is a story I've talked about here on this show literally for years, since the late parts of the Obama regime, when the criminal-in-chief was reported by multiple witnesses to have asked flag-ranked officers to pledge not their loyalty to the Constitution, but to him. And for those who wouldn't, don't let the door hit you in the you-know-what on the way out. It was rightly and widely called a purge. The conservative treehouse, though, has emphasized the Mattis item, saying, according to a pre-release excerpt from the WAPO, Bob Woodward writes about a discussion between General James Mattis and DNI, Director of National Intelligence, Don Coats, about a plot to overthrow the elected government of the United States. And what, they continue, do you call a conversation between the Secretary of Defense and the head of the U.S. intelligence apparatus when they're talking about taking, quote, collective action to remove an elected president? Well, in other words, it's called sedition, a seditious conspiracy. And says Woodberg, it began to be clear last October that the Obama administration, with some help from the Bill Clinton presidency, had seeded the Pentagon with leftist generals whose allegiance was to the deep state, to cultural leftism, and to the nefarious, infamous, and profitable military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about way back in 1961. And in only 5 years, Obama had conducted a major Pentagon purge, firing almost 200 senior officers who held the old-fashioned belief that the military exists to protect America and should not be an instrument of social justice with limited firepower. The upper-level officers who remained were hardcore Democrats. For example, while still in the military, Admiral McRaven gave Osama bin Laden a respectful private burial, or at least somebody we were told was him. Once out of the military, he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times, strongly suggesting a military coup against Trump. Barry McCaffrey, Clinton White House officer, likened Trump to Mussolini because he canceled the White House newspaper subscriptions. And Obama's Joint Chief Vice Chair, James Winnefield, was deeply offended on behalf of ISIS terrorist Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi because Trump did the psychologically smart thing of telling al-Baghdadi's followers that he died like a coward. In November, Sundance at the Conservative Treehouse pointed out that even though the infamous Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman used back channels to try to counteract his commander-in-chief's foreign policy solely because Vindman disagreed with the policy, the Defense Department invited him right back to the NSC. To Sundance, there was only one real takeaway. Quote, the United States military is collaborating with the CIA to remove a U.S. president from office. And all of the above suggests Woodberg says there's something rotten happening in the Pentagon. And the implications aren't just in the past, they're also in the future. Michael Anton has written the best article spelling out the fact, and we've been talking about it for a while, that Democrats are openly planning a coup if Biden doesn't win as planned. And one of the crucial points about this planned coup is that the Democrats have been explicit about military involvement. Their plan, in the event Trump wins in a given state, is to send Democrat electors to the Electoral College along with or even in lieu of the Republican electors. And in the chaos that results, which is intended to spill onto the streets, Democrats trust that, quote, the military would take care of the rest, unquote. Anton also says retired military officers, such as those discussed above, have already said they'll support a coup. And I'll add, says the author, it's likely that they still have allies within the Pentagon, people who benefit from the perpetual wars that Obama, who lied and claimed to be anti-war, nevertheless fought and instigated, and who also benefit from the pipeline flowing from the Pentagon to that profitable military-industrial complex. Furthermore, there's the laughable Atlantic article about how Trump disrespected the military. By the way, even John Bolton, no real friend of the president, has come out and said that the Atlantic story was, quote, simply false, and he was there. But the Atlantic's whopper, continues Woodberg, was intended not just to get military votes on November 3rd, but get military coup participants after that date. Likewise, critical race theory training and 8 years of Obama's socialist justice policies have shifted many of the enlisted ranks from being strong conservatives to equally strong far-left socialists. And the only way to put the kibosh on all of this, she suggests, is for an overwhelming Trump turnout on November 3rd. Otherwise, she suggests the upheaval spreads. Some of us, though, would say that's a lead pipe cinch anyway. Where I think we probably agree is that unless the traitors meet the full force of the law, and arguably, before about November 5th, at the very latest, there'll be no point in having what was called a rule of law anymore anyway. Next, from Glenn Greenwald, one of those rarest of things, an actual journalist that happens to lean pretty far left, but still manages to report the truth, objectively. MSM journalist, he writes, hate Julian Assange because he's broken more blockbuster stories than all of them combined. Nonsense, begins the summary here, courtesy of Zero Hedge. Julian Assange shouted during the second day of his resumed extradition hearing, as U.S. federal government attorney James Lewis told a witness that the WikiLeaks founder is facing extradition over the publication of informants' names, and not for merely handling leaked documents. And that, folks, is such a whopper, I don't blame Assange for being downright mad about it. The judge, Vanessa Barrister, promptly warned Assange, seated in the dock, basically behind a glass wall, that any further outburst would get him removed from the court, and the hearings, such as they are, would proceed without him. Writes Greenwald, the U.S. side is hinging its extradition request on the argument of prior claims that WikiLeaks, under Julian Assange's leadership, had revealed the names of sources, and those individuals were then disappeared, or, as we know it, Arkansided. According to the government's argument, suggesting that it was Assange who actually got U.S. operatives and assets detained or killed in foreign countries. But during the proceedings on Tuesday, U.S. wrongdoing was highlighted as well, with Reuters reporting, quote, Stafford Smith, dual U.S.-UK national, said the leaked information had contributed to court findings that criminal proceedings should be taken against senior U.S. officials, quote, I say this more in sadness than anger. I would never have believed that my government would do what it did, he said. We're talking about criminal offenses of torture, kidnapping, rendition, holding people without trial. Unquote. And doesn't that sound familiar? Meanwhile, as we've already mentioned, The Intercept's journalist noted Julian Assange and the group he founded, WikiLeaks, have broken more stories of historic importance than most of the U.S. and U.K. journalists who hate him combined. And he went on to ask, do these journalists, sick, despise Assange despite this fact or because of it? And he pointed out that years ago it was fairly accepted in liberal circles and in media circles that prosecuting Assange would be a grave threat to press freedom. But what's different this time, he underscores, is that now that it's Trump's DOJ doing it and liberals are silent to supportive because Assange heard Hitlery and the leftists, they want him imprisoned for that. Well, it could be worse, folks. If you've read Deep State Minion Deagle's projections, you realize they want 200 million or so of the rest of us dead. And we'll be right back after this. Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm still your host, Mark Hall. And let's talk a little bit in this segment about tyranny, propaganda, and social control, and various ways of subduing a populace so that they don't get uppity, but remain good little slaves and wear their masks. Why, if you do it right, they'll even bend over, take the vaccine, and get on the train cars when the time comes. So let's start here with one of the most infamous and thus long-denied secret programs in American history. And even though this finally slipped out, don't think they're not still continuing to do that kind of research under different secret program names. This is a piece called MKUltra, and as author Jason Morgan puts it for the Mises Institute, and the CIA's War on the Human Mind. And in particular, it's a summary of a book by Stephen Kinzer entitled Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. The CIA, he begins, has a fearsome reputation. The author and executor of countless coups and political assassinations, the CIA is notorious for waterboarding, extraordinary rendition, regime change, kidnapping, narcotic smuggling, financing guerrilla wars, and of course many other unsavory activities around the world, including against Americans, even though if we had a constitution, that wouldn't be allowed, and even inside the United States. But fearsome, notes the author, doesn't mean flawless, because the CIA has failed at least as often as it's succeeded. Sometimes the failures are so flagrant, like sending thousands of so-called anti-communist guerrilla fighters behind enemy lines in Korea, Eastern Europe, China, and Southeast Asia during the Cold War, where nearly all of them died. The CIA insiders wryly refer to their organization as clowns in action. And, of course, criminals in action is probably closer to the truth. Is the CIA merely a dastardly menace, or is it a hotbed of horrible mistakes? Well, Stephen Kinzer's new book, Poisoner-in-Chief, suggests the answer is both. The author is a veteran reporter on foreign conflicts such as those in Rwanda, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Iran, a former New York Times correspondent, and most famously, the author of the 2006 bestseller called Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change, From Hawaii to Iraq. And in his latest effort, he brings his analytical skills to bear on perhaps the most disturbing CIA project of them all, MKUltra, the top-secret, long-running effort to find methods, not just a method, but multiple methods, as it turns out, for controlling the human mind. Writes Kinzer, history's most systematic search for techniques of mind control was a byproduct of World War II. And the story starts this way. At the end of 1942, a University of Wisconsin bacteriologist named Ira Baldwin, America's first bio-warrior, he's been called, and a part-time Quaker preacher, was loaned to Washington with the blessing of the president of UW. In order to set up and run a bioweapons program for the United States military. Based out of Camp Dietrich in Maryland, the Baldwin lab cranked out bioweapons for possible use against Allied enemies. And in one of his bigger projects, shipment of tons of anthrax spores, ordered by Winston Churchill, potentially for use against the Nazis, was approved by President Franklin D. Roosevelt and almost ready for delivery by the time Germany surrendered on May 7th of 1945. Bottom line, World War II seems to have cleared away the last of the psychological hurdles, even for Quaker preachers, against unleashing bioweapons against an enemy. And, of course, the justification is the bigger war, the Cold War, which followed the demise, well, at least on paper, of the Third Reich, which, as it turned out, provided much of the original brain power for MKUltra, via something you may have heard of, we've talked about it here before, Operation Paperclip. Immediately after World War II, says the book, the CIA, formed out of the Office of War Information in 1945, was faced with a choice. The Germans and the Japanese had been conducting advanced experiments with germ warfare and other forms of biological weaponry. So should the Allies pursue and prosecute as war criminals the scientists involved with those projects, or just hire them as expert advisors? Well, with the Cold War starting and the Soviets looming as an unpredictable enemy, the CIA, with the tacit approval of the few members of the United States Congress who are even allowed to know about the existence of the agency, probably because if most of them had known, they'd have said, hey, where in the Constitution is this allowed? Well, maybe by 1945 they were beyond that, but certainly if they don't know, they can't stop it. And they decided to make use of the bioweapons expertise of erstwhile foes in order to counter the new adversary, even though World War II ally, in Moscow. For example, Kurt Blohm, Nazi director of biowarfare research and development, whose work had been championed by none other than Heinrich Himmler, was acquitted, first by American political fiat at the doctor's trial in Nuremberg in 1947, and then sent to work as part of the aforementioned Operation Paperclip, designed, at least ostensibly, mostly to bring German rocket scientists to the U.S. at Camp Dietrich. And it was there that Blohm encountered a rising star in the CIA, the infamous Sidney Gottlieb, a bacteriological specialist who'd been a star student of Ira Baldwin's at Wisconsin. And that's the main figure in Kinzer's book. His career, as it turns out, is virtually synonymous with MKUltra, and under the direction of Gottlieb, the CIA labs at Camp Dietrich transitioned from R&D on bioweapons, often using unwitting American subjects, like in 1950 when a U.S. Navy minesweeper, quote, specifically equipped with large aerosol hoses, unquote, spent 6 days spreading something called Serratia marcescens bacterium into the San Francisco fog, infecting some 800,000 people. To drugs which could be used for mind control. MK Naomi, the sister project in the CIA of MK Ultra, was also tasked with finding poisons and biotoxins which the CIA and Big Brother U.S. government could use in various operations. Gottlieb provided the big ideas into which to fit Blohm's nefarious knowledge of mass murder by bacillus. And Gottlieb became, virtually overnight and with the help of these former Nazi doctors, America's poisoner-in-chief. And notably, the CIA's mind control program, which assumed bigger and bigger importance as fears of Soviet brainwashing grew in the U.S., was originally called Operation Bluebird and was personally overseen by CIA higher-up Alan Dulles. At first, the Bluebird team experimented with, quote, hypnosis, electroshock, and sensory deprivation, along with drugs like sodium amytal at CIA sites in secret prisons in Germany and Japan, looking for ways to extract information out of POWs and captured spies. But Dulles was unsatisfied with those results and decided to give the young CIA recruit Sidney Gottlieb control of Bluebird's updated iteration. This one was called Operation Artichoke, the goal of which was to do whatever it takes to get prisoners to divulge military and state secrets to the CIA, and the Cold War would brook nothing short of full-scale war against the human mind. Dulles became deputy director of the CIA 3 days after launching Project Artichoke in 1951, and Gottlieb, still invisible to the outside world, was given virtually unlimited rein to carry out any experiments he wanted or thought necessary in order to achieve mind control. And this drive to achieve total operational control over the human psyche eclipsed all reality and tactical limitation. Because if the U.S. didn't win the war to the mind control methods, many in the CIA thought, well, the entire American population lay vulnerable to mental enslavement by the Soviets. Full stop, folks. Basically, what we've seen is, forget the Soviets. What you really have to worry about is enslavement by Big Brother. And witness the very effective programs that are currently being rolled out all around us. Writes Kinzer, Dulles despised a disastrously unsuccessful 3-year artichoke attack on a Bulgarian political prisoner named Dmitry Dimitrov and had convinced himself not only that mind control techniques exist, but that communists had discovered them, and this posed a mortal threat to the rest of the world. Mind control, therefore, was the pressing need, but nothing seemed to be able to bring it within reach. Technique after technique, drug after drug, was tried on prisoners, but to no avail. So in frustration, artichoke agents under Gottlieb upped the ante, turning to marijuana, cocaine, and then heroin as possible catalysts of CIA-directed anti-Soviet brainwashing. And as part of artichoke, a University of Rochester psychology professor was given a grant by the U.S. Navy to test heroin on his students. But the control of the mind remained as elusive as ever, despite the massive dosing of the Rochester student population with opiates. Aren't these wonderful folks? Nothing seemed to have the potential to crack open the mind for the CIA. And then someone in Artichoke suggested using mescaline after other narcotics failed, and this gave Sidney Gottlieb an idea. He remembered hearing about a drug called LSD, which Dr. Albert Hoffman had discovered during an experiment in Basel, Switzerland, back during the war in 1943. Lysergic acid diethylamide, you may have heard it, produced extraordinarily disturbing psychological effects, found Dr. Hoffman, when he ingested some and recorded them. Washington learned about Hoffman's case in 1949, and one of the chemical specialists in the U.S. military complex told Gottlieb about the wonderful new substance, whereupon in 1951, Gottlieb asked Harold Abramson, who'd been a physician in the Chemical Warfare Service during World War II, to administer LSD to him. Whereupon Gottlieb experienced the same psychedelic state that Dr. Hoffman had described. So other subjects were tested, not all of them wittingly, and all seemed to exhibit similar reactions. Yep, LSD most definitely altered the mind. And Gottlieb was convinced he'd found the magical drug which would allow the CIA to control the psyche, and therefore beat the Soviets at their own game. The experiments on human subjects followed rapidly after Gottlieb's conversion to belief in the powers of LSD. Even though the experiments often ended in death, sometimes it could have been called murder. He described some of the experiments and noted that similar experimentation and executions were carried out not only in Japan, but also Korea and Germany, and Gottlieb was usually involved personally. Throughout the 1950s, the experimentation continued. An American artist named Sidney Glickman was lured to a bar near his studio in Paris by CIA agents in 1951, and the chemical was slipped into his drink. He began to hallucinate wildly, fled in a state of panic, and remained in his Paris apartment for the next 10 months, hiding in paranoia until his family finally came to take him home, and then he spent the rest of his life as a near invalid. The chemical which the CIA had slipped into Glickman's drink was almost certainly LSD, and Glickman, suggests the author, had been chosen by the CIA because he'd just recovered from hepatitis, and Team Artichoke was conducting an experiment on the effects of hepatic infection on the efficacy of LSD. Well, things went downhill from there. In 52, the CIA commissioned underworld denizen and former vice cop George Hunter White to run a human subjects experiment at 81 Bedford Street in Greenwich Village, New York. White's job was to bring to that CIA apartment various expendables. See, folks, now the media and CIA call them deplorables, on whom Gottlieb and his team could test LSD. White knew the whores, the pimps, and the people who brought in the drugs, as one of Gottlieb's MKUltra colleagues later explained, and this made him invaluable for procuring the drug users, petty criminals, and others who could be relied upon not to complain about what had happened to them when these CIA experiments were finished. Ponder this, folks. Now we have an entire society filled with mask wearers who'll do the same thing. They've certainly made quite a bit of progress. Many suffered nervous breakdowns, and of course, some died. In order to keep the supply of LSD flowing, CIA agents went to Basel, Switzerland, where LSD had been discovered, and tried to buy everything they had in stock. Alan Dulles authorized just under $250,000 outlay, and that was back when it was real money, to pay for it. Sandoz held the patent for Hoffman's discovery, but he wanted nothing to do with the drug, so Gottlieb, free of any need to scruple over IP infringement, tasked U.S. big pharma company Eli Lilly with making LSD in the States. And with their mind control serum in production, MKUltra agents could now focus on how to dose experimental subjects. They even hired a professional magician named John Mulholland to teach Gottlieb and his agents how to deliver LSD into the food and drink of unsuspecting subjects without being detected. Gottlieb recruited a Kentucky addiction specialist named Dr. Henry Isbell to test LSD and the new mind-altering drugs on various prisoners and patients, destroying more lives. And among the victims of another of Gottlieb's agent doctors was none other than the infamous James Whitey Bulger. The mafioso, who along with 19 other inmates at the Atlanta Federal Pen beginning in 1957, was given LSD nearly every day for 15 months without being told what it was, resulting in Bulger being plagued for the rest of his life with nightmares, suicidal thoughts, and, quote, deep depression. Oh, and if you're wondering where else you might have heard the name Whitey Bulger, folks, who died in prison, arguably suspiciously, think Big Brother's primary fixer and, oh yeah, Russia prosecutor Robert Mueller. And the man who was told he was taking part in experiments designed to help find a cure for schizophrenia didn't learn the truth about what had been done to him until 1979. The rest of us still don't know the truth. The human toll of Gottlieb's MK-Ultra experiments continued to mount. One of Gottlieb's closest associates in the project, Frank Olson, bacteriologist trained at the University of Wisconsin, who'd been recruited for the CIA by his mentor, Ira Baldwin, began to express doubts about what the MK-Ultra team was doing. He told his wife he'd made a terrible mistake in his work and shared his misgivings, with his CIA colleagues as well. His conscience appeared to be getting the better of him, and of course, that meant he was a liability to the team. Late in 1953, Gottlieb surreptitiously dosed Olson with LSD at a backwoods MK-Ultra gathering called Deep Creek Rendezvous outside Camp Dietrich, whereupon Olson spiraled into a frightening disorientation, and early in the morning on November 28th of that same year, just after Thanksgiving, Olson fell, or maybe jumped, from a window of the Statler Hotel in Manhattan, dying just after hitting the concrete below. Who could have imagined such a thing? Another MK-Ultra agent, Gottlieb's lieutenant Robert Lashbrook, the only other person in the room when Olson either fell or jumped, told the New York City PD that Olson had jumped out of the window and his death was originally designated as suicide, but the Olson family eventually grew suspicious, gee, do you think, and an investigation was carried out, including a new autopsy on the man's body. And after a month of examination of the corpse, the forensic pathologist declared, "I think Frank Olson was intentionally, deliberately, and with malice aforethought, thrown out of that window." Interestingly, wounds on Olson's body were consistent with methods taught in CIA manuals for first incapacitating people and then killing them in order to make their deaths look self-inflicted. What can you say, folks? These are just wonderful people. Why, some still think Seth Rich and others on Bill and Hillary's dead list actually did it themselves. But Jeffrey Epstein, maybe, like Christmas ornaments and wallpaper, are in fact three things that don't hang themselves. Gottlieb and MK-Ultra were shaken by the demise of Olson, yeah, sure, but they carried on stalwartly with their work, spent the next few years looking for magic mushrooms in Mexico, arranging suicide capsules for American agents, including Gary Powers, the U-2 pilot, who chose not to use his when he was shot down over the Soviet Union, and famously attempting, at the order of then-Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, to assassinate Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, after things like exploding cigars were ruled out. But Gottlieb did try it with a wetsuit laced with fungi and bacteria. Eventually, they hooked people like Allen Ginsberg and other radicals on LSD, as well as some other high-profile assassination attempts. Funny, this piece doesn't spend too much ink on Timothy Leary, but a lot of us have heard that part of the story. Says the piece, Gottlieb's career brought ruin and suffering to untold numbers of people, many of them innocent. He retired from the CIA in 1973 after receiving the Distinguished Intelligence Medal. I surely better say sick after that. And when Gottlieb and his wife moved to the rural Virginia countryside and attempted to blend in with the small community there, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, who'd won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, learned about the MH Chaos program targeting Americans, and the American Congress was finally forced to act. Gottlieb's career, long a well-kept secret, was being brought out into the open, and his retirement might end up being far from peaceful. But there, though, were still many who tried to cover up what Gottlieb and the other MK-Ultra agents had done. In 1975, after the outcry caused by the Hearst reporting, President Gerald Ford deputized VP Nelson Rockefeller, oh yeah, that'll fix it, to chair a commission on the CIA. That's almost as disgusting as Comey investigating himself. Even though new CIA Director William Colby was said to be remarkably frank, and he informed the Rockefeller Commission that, yep, the CIA had conducted LSD experiments that resulted in deaths. Later he referred to assassination plots. Whereupon, good old Nelson Rockefeller, attempting to prevent the CIA director from revealing too much, buttonholed Colby and said, quote, "Bill, do you really have to present all this material to us?" Yes, just in case you've forgotten, this is, in fact, the same Bill Colby who left his breakfast on the table largely uneaten and decided to go out for a row in his canoe by himself on the Potomac without even bothering to tell anybody he was going and never came back.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
More importantly, perhaps, in 1977, in the wake of the Church Report on further excesses of so-called American intelligence, Senator Edward Kennedy, RFK's brother, spurred on by some documents that had been discovered as a result of a FOIA request, in spite of Gottlieb having ordered all MKUltra files burned, some copies remained, called Admiral Stansfield Turner to testify before Congress on MKUltra. As the walls were closing in, Gottlieb himself was eventually forced to testify, albeit in a closed-room setting that his lawyer had helped to arrange, and he pleaded amnesia. Nearly all of his answers to questions about MKUltra were something on the order of, I do not recall, and it would have appeared, anyway, that the matter ended there. Still, though, the skeletons in Gottlieb's closet would not go away. In 1984, the disgusting man agreed to meet with the family of Frank Olson, former MKUltra colleague who'd, well, ended up flying out of the window from that Manhattan hotel room over 30 years earlier. And Eric Olson, Frank's son, unconvinced by Gottlieb's explanation, and after his widow and Eric's mother had passed away, ordered Frank's body exhumed in 1984. As information about MKUltra built into the public's awareness, other cases were reopened, including that of Stanley Glickman. So the courts were finally involved, and Gottlieb couldn't count on the CIA to get him out of his legal troubles. He pushed back against the trial for Glickman's murder as long as he could, and finally, in early March of 1999, Sidney Gottlieb died. Like Frank Olson, though, it was never officially revealed whether or not the death was a suicide or assisted. Concludes this piece, Poisoner-in-Chief is a highly readable, thoroughly researched introduction to the life and work of one of America's most unknown and yet, somehow, infamous government agents. Some of us might even say servants of the satanic deep state. Even if you think you know a bit about MKUltra, says the author, you might be surprised by some of the nefarious schemes that the book outlines. And all in all, to see in one volume a rendering of just some of the lives ruined by just one CIA program, MKUltra, is in fact a sobering revelation. Now at this point, folks, I have to add a couple of things. For one, MKUltra is literally almost ancient history. Just imagine how much further they've come in the years since. And ultimately, you really don't have to imagine. Just look and see how effective they've been at not only propagandizing an entire formerly free country, but getting so many people to drink the Kool-Aid on so many levels and literally commit suicide themselves. From fluoride to GMO to aspartame to 5G and, yep, God alone knows what, and maybe some of the evil people in the deep state swamp, there's no shortage of things being done to people en masse nowadays and largely without their notice or understanding. Yep, they've even got most of them convinced that if you know about it or think it's important, you must be a booga 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 conspiracy theorist. And this might be the best summary of the entire situation here. Gottlieb was, of course, heavily involved in New Age mysticism. Some of us might say pretty much indistinguishable from Satanism of the very old age. And he appears to have expended considerable energy psychologically compartmentalizing his so-called work, even though there were indications that he was aware that the experiments he and his MKUltra team were conducting were, at best, unethical, and at worst, outright satanic, not to mention crimes. They would put it differently, of course. The ends justify the means, and they were willing to do whatever it might take. And isn't it interesting? That seems to be the modus operandi of most of the deep state, and they're not even trying to hide it anymore, of those who have now picked up the mantle and followed their satanic footsteps. And like all of these anti-patriots that put their hand on a Bible and lie, well, at least in some cases, they make the same claim. Yeah, they were willing to do whatever it took to defend a country that, arguably, they helped destroy from within in the process. Color me unsatisfied with the claim that these people are anything but evil to the core. Here's a headline and a story, courtesy of Daniel Horowitz in the Conservative Review, also places like Zero Hedge, that almost needs no other information to make the point. Thousands of cases, it says, but zero hospitalizations in college. Good news, but states are still forcing draconian lockdowns anyway. After being open for weeks, he writes, college campuses have no reported deaths or even hospitalizations that I could find, but still, thousands of cases. Yeah, they're even having parties because they know there's nothing to fear, and that is the real problem. They're asymptomatic, not a hospitalization to be found, and how is this an emergency situation? If anything, the fact that there are so many cases must be a blessing, suggests Horowitz, because in such a young population, it's almost like they had a de facto vaccine, creating herd immunity with no real danger. And who knows how many of them are false positives anyway. It's becoming obvious, he concludes, that the only real thing the virus is spreading is an incorrigible psychosis. Rather than quarantining youth or something no worse than a cold, maybe it's time to start confining some of these so-called public health officials to a mental health facility. Quite frankly, folks, I think this is the only place where he's being too kind, because they're clearly part of the insurrection. We'll close today with a quick bit of upbeat news, courtesy of Paul Joseph Watson and Summit News, out of Spain, where video showed the Spanish Gestapo trying to arrest an elderly woman for actuando not wearing her mask. And they have low-flying helicopters with loudspeakers to enforce the COVID-1984 rules besides. But they failed in their takedown. Why? As the state-licensed thugs tried to pull the older woman away from the crowd, dozens of people took off their masks, put on their backbone, and helped the woman. Hear, hear. It's past time, folks, for Americans to choose this day whom you will serve.